From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a cottage in Dallas. A brand new 400-square-foot space is home to a man named Gregory, who didn't have a home for nearly 30 years. He lived on the streets, moving from town to town throughout three decades. His cottage is part of a community designed for the 50 most chronically homeless people in Dallas. And when he moved in, Gregory found a toaster, a crock pot, a stove, and a toothbrush and toothpaste. He described his cottage as heaven. An architect named John Carey told Gregory's story in a recent TED Talk, and it's one example of what he calls dignity in design. The concept refers to including the people who live in and use the spaces designed for them in the planning for those spaces. It's an idea that's embraced by architects who work in affordable housing design and including our guest for the hour, Katie Swenson. Swenson is the Vice President of National Design Initiatives at Enterprise Community Partners in Boston. She'll be in Rochester this week for the Reshaping Rochester series. But first, she's our guest on the line for Connections. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And also with us in studio is Eugenio Marlin, who is Executive Vice President of Ibero-American Development Corporation, representing the Community Design Center of Rochester this hour. Eugenio, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Brett Garwood is here. He's Chief Operating Officer for Home Leasing, which is a sponsor of the series. And Brett, welcome back to the program to you.
Thank you.
On Wednesday night, 7 to 9 at the Gleason Works Auditorium, Katie Swenson will be here lecturing on a number of subjects, including how Rochester can inform its future planning using inspiration from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we're going to talk about the beloved community when facing poverty and its effects on planning and a lot more this hour. But Katie, before we do that, why don't you tell us a little bit more about what National Design Initiatives is and the work that you're doing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I work at Enterprise Community Partners, a national organization. We serve low-income communities across the United States in both their affordable housing and larger community development needs. And as an architect and a sustainability advocate, I have been working at Enterprise for about 12 years, trying to increase the quality of design of our affordable housing, as well as increasing our capacity to do community engagement in each of the places where we work.
And before we even get into the career work, and when we talk about community engagement when it comes to housing and our design spaces, let's talk a little bit about your backstory, because you did not start out in this field. Tell us about that.
Well, I guess how far back do you want me to go?
I found it so interesting because, here you are and you've got this passion for the field, but you started out in dance, right?
Yes, I've been a gymnast and dancer and athlete my whole life. And I went to the University of California, Berkeley, where I studied comparative literature, but also was an avid dancer. And upon graduation, I moved to New York City and worked and struggled along with many others as a modern dancer in the city. But while I was there, I was involved in a lot of other things, of course, including working with many designers and fabricators and kind of also getting to know my local community and being involved there. So the path to architecture school was perhaps not predestined, but was an exciting opportunity for me as I was deciding that my dance career might have to take a more amateur part of my daily life, and I refocused my career on architecture.
I think in so many ways, from what I'm reading about the work that you do and some of the philosophy that you really believe in, I think this path has been really effective for you in helping not just go from the academic approach, but from sort of a lived experience and understanding a little bit of struggle and understanding what a community-based architect might be. And if you consider yourself a community-based architect, what's the short definition you give people for when they say, well, I know what an architect is. What's a community-based architect?
Yeah, it's been just an absolutely wonderful career path. I think I was exceptionally lucky to, as soon as I graduated from architecture school, I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia. I went to the University of Virginia to get my master's in architecture. And I started to work with a local community-based affordable housing developer. in Charlottesville, first as a volunteer. I was interested in how to help, actually, first the neighborhood that I lived in. There was a Section 8 housing development in my neighborhood, which was full of wonderful people, but was just terribly kept up. And it kind of sparked my interest in how do we create dignified spaces, in John Kerry's beautiful words, for people of all income groups. So I was lucky to be in the second class of fellows of a program called the Enterprise Rose Architectural Fellowship, which partnered architects with community-based affordable housing developers. And through 3 years as a fellow working on staff, I was able to participate in sort of collaborative decision-making and community design of the neighborhoods in which my nonprofit developer was building. So I learned through that experience that, of course, residents of neighborhoods are really the sort of experts in what their neighborhoods need. And if we could combine that kind of local resident experience with the technical talents and skills of architects and developers, you come up with a lasting benefit to the community.
I want to listen, if we could, to a clip from a recent TED Talk by John Kerry, an architect and writer whom I think you know, Katie, or do you know John?
I do. We've been collaborating since about 2000, maybe three or four.
Okay. And so in this talk, he's talking about how architecture can create dignity for all, and talking in various ways about how what we design and where we design it tends to come largely from a population of wealthy, white, you know, a pretty elite group of architects. And that's not to say that it is malicious or malintended, but that there is a limited experience set in a lot of our architecture and a lot of our design space, wherever it is, and there are consequences to that. So let's first listen to what some of John Kerry had to say. In this talk, he is talking first about, he talked about how the hospital room that his wife was in while delivering their first daughter, you know, she was having contractions and all she had to stare at in front of her was a clock, not something a woman in labor tends to want to do. His talk focused on how the people who use the spaces being designed should be involved themselves in planning for those spaces. And when he discusses bathrooms, he refers to men designing bathrooms for women. He says women should be designing bathrooms that better suit their needs.
I went into architecture because I believed it was about creating spaces for people to live their best lives. And yet what I found is a profession largely disconnected from the people most directly impacted by its work. I believe this is because architecture remains a white, male elitist profession, seemingly unconcerned with some of the greatest needs in the world, or even the relatively simple needs of an expectant mother. The contemporary world was literally built by men who have rarely taken the time to understand how people unlike them experience their designs. A long bathroom line might seem like a minor indignity, but the opposite can also be true. Thoughtful design can make people feel respected and seen. I've come to believe that dignity is to design what justice is to law and health is to medicine. In the simplest of terms, it's about having the spaces you inhabit reflect back your value.
All right, Katie Swenson, I'll start with you. You want to expand on some of those comments?
Oh, yeah. It's such a beautiful trilogy, what justice is to law and health is to medicine, dignity is to design. You know, last week I was in Southern California. I was on the border of San Ysidro and Tijuana first, and then second in the Skid Row neighborhood in Los Angeles. And I wouldn't be surprised if I'd bring these examples up on Wednesday because they're just clear and present reminders for me. In both places, we had supported two architects working there a Latino man who was born in Juarez and who came to the U.S. when he was 8 years old. His father was deported when he was 19. And it's incredible to hear from him how that personal experience has formed his lifelong career path. He started working as a Rhodes Fellow in San Ysidro in 2001, and he is still there and will remain there probably for the rest of his life, doing everything he can to understand how to help repair the fabric of communities and families that are split by this border, that are connected by this border. And I see how his lived experience translates directly into this kind of beautiful community development and architecture in that town. Meanwhile, Teresa Wong, who is a Korean-American woman from New York originally, not from Los Angeles, but started working in the Skid Row neighborhood in 2009. And I think when she first arrived there, she was as shocked as we all are when we go to a place of such extreme poverty and disinvestment. And her first thought was, you know, can I do this? You know, speaking of restrooms, I guess we just wish there were some in Skid Row for the 3,500 plus people who live on the streets. But Teresa was part of generating a community-based plan called Our Skid Row. And while that plan has not been adopted by the city, the 385 plus residents who had input in it called in part for a sort of series of hygiene centers. And I did see a new center called Refresh, which was a community-based shower and hygiene center, but also had, you know, music and art and, you know, limited kind of sense of security from a policing standpoint, but rather sort of a community-based approach. So I am seeing a new generation of architects who are not all white and they're not all male, who care deeply about their communities and are relating to questions of maybe urban planning or architecture or design with a real sense of empathy and connection to the residents, either they serve or really more to the point to their neighbors and their own community, which they've really made in many ways their own.
Yeah, this is a great moment for me to let our audience know. I would love to hear from listeners as to where they experience design that sometimes seems clumsy or not very thoughtful for needs. You know, John Kerry, the architect, in his TED Talk talked about everything from the labor delivery room that his wife experienced to the way people experience long bathroom lines or sort of unthoughtfully created spaces in public spaces. And certainly our friends in the disability community can relate to that, you know, so when design doesn't really expand thoughtfully in certain directions. If there's something that comes to mind for you, I'd love to hear about it. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Katie, this part of the conversation for me reminds me a bit of a discussion about teaching populations. And we did an extended series on the lack of teachers of color, both in suburban districts and in the Rochester City School District. It's underrepresentation for Latino school children, for Black school children. It's just a big underrepresentation. And one of the themes we heard was this. Number one, overall, you need better representation, period. It can't be all white. And number two, just because you're a white male teaching doesn't mean you can't relate, but you've got to work hard. You've got to do the work to understand my experience may not perfectly suit me, and what can I do to get outside that? So can you tell me a little bit about this idea? Because I'm sure you're not saying that white males shouldn't be architects.
No. You know, it's architecture is, I believe, sort of still by the numbers, 80% white and 80% male. So the fact that John Kerry states that is, you know, is still true to this day. In our recruitment program, you know, we're about 50% female, and probably over a third, but not quite a half, people of color. But certainly people are working in neighborhoods that may or may not reflect their own ethnic or racial background as well. So many people are on a learning curve. There's a, and people who may be of a certain race are not necessarily grow up in low-income situations. So I think for all of us, the good thing about having, for example, this group of fellows is that you sort of are learning constantly from each other. And all of us at Enterprise are working hard to come clear with the sort of history of how supremacist attitudes towards race have played out in the built environment and what are the ramifications of that and those decisions of the past. And how do we be both aware of them and seek to dismantle them in the present?
All right, so let me ask Eugenio and Brett then to weigh in on that. Eugenio, how do you see some of the comments that John Kerry, that he talked about, you know, sort of missing the needs of certain communities for design? Do you see any of that in Rochester? Does that concern you?
Oh, sure. We have been concentrating in the Clinton Avenue area, and there is a community there that is mixed in culturally and otherwise. And when we develop, we want to see the expression of that community. So that basically necessitates when we talk to architects, to people that are receptive to those changes, that are, really want to listen to the constituents in a very respectful and assertive way. So we do see that, and the community wants to see what they want to see in the community that will fit their particular needs.
Hmm. Brett, how do you see it?
Yeah, with home leasing, we're primarily an affordable housing developer, but as a housing developer, especially one focused on affordable housing, you see the history of affordable housing in Rochester like every other community. There's a long past history of a very badly designed affordable housing that obviously had nothing to do with being designed with the community needs associated. High concentration of very small units that are poorly built, and we've been dealing with that history for a long time. But as we do affordable housing development now, we are very much integrated into community development processes, which is a very difficult thing to do. Home leasing's example would be Voters Block Community, which is part of a community development plan and was designed to be associated with the location of Susan B. Anthony's first vote, right? That design and the community were part of it.
All right, so it sounds to me like when you say the design in the community was part of it, it wasn't just sort of top-down designers, planners, architects saying, well, here's what you're going to have, and we're going to put it right here. It was a conversation. Does this work here? What are your needs? How do you live? What do you want to see?
Exactly. There was neighborhood planning effort, there was community engagement process, and there was design processes that actually involved the community. Now, that's hard work, and not everybody will agree that it was done perfectly.
Well, I don't know any project that everyone would say was perfect, but certainly if there is more of a thoughtful and community-based intention and first steps, that probably puts you farther down the road than many projects in the past. So Katie Swenson, who's on the line with us, is the Vice President of National Design Initiatives at Enterprise Community Partners. That's out of Boston. She's coming to Rochester for the Reshaping Rochester series, and she will be here Wednesday night, 7 to 9 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. It is a free event. And so let's talk about what you're going to be speaking about specifically here in the theme on Wednesday night. Katie?
Yes. Well, we chose the theme of love. We have been inspired by working recently in Atlanta and certainly learning from some of their planning efforts and, of course, of the history that Martin Luther King brought to that community and to all of us. So He had a concept that we know called the beloved community, which sort of certainly saw as a vision in which all people share in the wealth of the earth, and that in fact poverty and homelessness and hunger are not tolerated. And we've been thinking a lot about this question of love. It may seem strange to put that in a professional context, but one of my mentors uses a definition of love, which says that love is the recognition of another as a legitimate other. And in some ways, my experience in Los Angeles is speaks to this notion that sometimes we may say, for example, the homeless, and think of people without homes as belonging to an identity of being homeless, which may be home is so associated with sort of our centers, our families, our souls. And so the sense that one might not recognize the sort of authenticity of another because of their living conditions or because of their income conditions seems to have the potential to generate very malignant policies at a city level. So we're going to talk a little bit about how to understand communities that have experienced trauma in the past through urban planning, and hopefully talk about how to think about healing in those communities using love as well as other urban planning tools.
In our second half hour, I'd like to, if you don't mind, Katie, talk a little bit about what you've seen and what's been happening in places like L.A., the Richardson Apartments, San Francisco, for example. But before we do that, let me grab our first phone call. This is Edward in Rochester. Go ahead, Edward.
Hi, Evan. So I was listening, and I see that there's a lot of attention being paid to the ethnicities of the architects. And I guess, you know, a history lesson isn't necessary, but maybe just I'd suggest that America is more classist than we'd allow ourselves to believe that we are, and that the race divisions are really more of a circumstantial element to class, pitting lower class people against one another. So it doesn't strike me as surprising that the ethnicity that has power would be hiring inside of their own ethnicity, but also making choices that would be more about their position in their class and saving themselves money and less about the impact of the citizens who live and work in there. This seems more of a class issue than a race one, and I think that was being talked about just a second ago. I'd like to suggest that maybe we need to recognize that more of these projects need to be coming from the community's interest and our cultural meaning behind these buildings and places that we, you know, live in and that we facilitate, and less about providing a space at a low expense for some wealthy upper-class businessmen.
Edward, thank you. A lot to work with, and I really appreciate all of the thoughts there. I'm going to start with Katie Swenson for some thoughts, and then we'll turn to our guests in studio. Go ahead, Katie.
You know, I'd certainly think a local response might be helpful. I think that for, in many ways we all recognize, and, you know, my colleague was talking about affordable housing, and we all know that we all sort of need both housing that is affordable to us as well as all the other sort of access to opportunities in our futures, including education and health and well-being, economic security. We need transportation. You know, we need all of these different pieces to live a whole life. And it's very clear that access to those opportunities is not equal amongst people of different classes, for sure. And, you know, and sometimes that's broken down by race as well. I'm I don't think I'll take on that larger issue because I don't feel qualified necessarily to give this sort of socioeconomics of that situation. But I think what we do know is that that America's, you know, it's the idea of an American dream and access to opportunity is fatally, or hopefully not fatally, but is seriously broken at the moment. And is not providing that kind of access of opportunity to all.
All right, so let me turn to Eugenio Merlin, who is Executive Vice President of Ibero-American Development Corporation. When we think about equity of design and the way we thoughtfully construct spaces, private and public spaces, is it more of an issue of class, or do you think it's an issue of race? Do you think it's both?
I think there's a little bit of both. And One of the big issues is that as we address affordable housing and low-income housing, we are coming from a deficit perspective, because what we're doing is remediating long-standing mores in the community, that include even design and where people live. That is why it is absolutely necessary to fully engage members of the community, and we have to also keep in mind when we are developing that you don't want to totally part with history. So there's always this challenge there where we want to go one way full tilt, and it is a slow process that has to happen. But definitely there is an issue of class and race.
All right, Brett Garwood, Chief Operating Officer for Home Leasing. What do you think?
Well, certainly class and economic opportunity have a lot to do with it. I think people, minorities, face barriers that others might not, even with low incomes. But when we talk about design so far, we've focused on what it looks like. It's also what does it actually provide? And one of the things that you see increasingly, and we're proud of this, I think, as a community, is that we're providing new housing opportunities that provide housing that's affordable in very integrated areas or integrated communities. For example, Home Leasing's working on Charlotte Street. We'll have three phases of projects. When those projects are done, there'll be rents there that are between in the 500s to over $2,400. That is true economic integration, in addition to providing some units that for people who are coming from difficult circumstances and would otherwise be homeless. That is what we need to do from a design point of view, that policy point of view, to help address some of these issues.
Just from a listener named Joel, he says he thinks the issue of equity of design, whether it is about class or race, he says it's both, and he says this issue is getting played out in the Plex neighborhood in Rochester. He said white developers and architects putting forth plans that do not, in many ways, align with the neighborhood residents' wants and needs. It's Joel's opinion. I'm certainly not all that familiar with what's going on in Plex, which is just reading a note from for our producer Megan Mack. Plex is centered on the parallel roadways of South Plymouth and Exchange. Parts of Plex are included in the Third Ward Historic District, largely residential area where University of Rochester students live. Joel, thank you for that. Let me just read a quick comment from an email from a listener named Sarah on sort of thoughtful design or not. And I want to turn this back to Katie Swenson, our guest on the phone, who is coming here for an event Wednesday night. Sarah writes to us and says, when it comes to poorly designed spaces, my first thought is always public bathrooms. I am the mother of two very young children, a two-year-old and a four-month-old. I dread when I have to go into a bathroom with both of them. I have not found a stall anywhere near large enough to accommodate myself, the toddler, and the car seat with the baby. In order to make it work, I am forced to use the stalls designed for people who use wheelchairs, etc., and I am very uncomfortable doing that. I just want to be able to go out with my kids. A few places do have family bathrooms, and those are wonderful. More establishments need bathrooms like that. That's from Sarah. What do you think, Katie?
Well, I think that gets straight to John's point that the users should be the designers and the informers of the process, right? You know, we all find that we get into moments of our lives or we have different challenges. We had a really wonderful woman in Boston named Atiya Martin, who was leading the resilience efforts for the city of Boston. And she presented last summer, she's looking at issues of race and racism in Boston and how our resilience policy needs to address that. So that's her primary issue. But when she was giving her remarks, she had been having some health challenges and using a cane for the preceding few months. And she had a quote that I found to be really compelling, which was, "If it's not our struggle, it's invisible to us." And I think that's one of the reasons why we need to diversify who the us is. We all encounter different sort of struggles in our lives at different times. I was a young mother once, and now my children are in high school and college. So, you know, that issue of, let's say, the stroller is not necessarily front of mind for me. It's hopefully not invisible to me, but it's not front of mind. So how do we understand how to go through sort of our own lives, being aware of the challenges that we face and being able to bring those, understanding that other people face those challenges too? And then how do we develop a greater sense of sort of empathy and interest and curiosity about the lives and situations of others as we're, you know, creating our spaces or our policies or our parking lots or our cars or our restaurants or whatever it is?
Just a reminder, listeners, Wednesday night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium. It's a free event with our guest, Katie Swenson. She is coming to Rochester for the Reshaping Rochester series. Recipes for Community Changes is the theme from the Community Design Center of Rochester, and she is going to be talking about a number of the themes we're discussing this hour. So 7 to 9 p.m. at Gleason Works Auditorium Wednesday night, and the event is free. Let's go ahead and get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with Katie Swenson, Vice President of National Design Initiatives at Enterprise Community Partners out of Boston. Eugenia Marlene is in studio with me, Executive Vice President of Ibero-American Development Corporation, and Brett Garwood, Chief Operating Officer for Home Leasing here in Rochester. Short break and right back next. Coming up in our second hour, do you only drink sparkling wine to celebrate something or when someone hands you a glass? Do you think of it as an everyday beverage? The Finger Lakes has really dominated Riesling in American winemaking, but what about sparkling wine? What about climate change and the way it impacts what we can grow? And how are wines made? What are the business decisions of the future for this region? We discuss all of that next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Katie Swenson on the line with us has some experience, I think, to back up some of the conversation we're having about efforts that are truly inclusive and, I think, thoughtful when it comes to community design or efforts to really create spaces that work. And can we talk a little bit about Star Apartments in LA and Richardson Apartments in San Francisco, Katie?
Oh, sure. I'd love to.
All right. So let's start in LA. What happened there?
Yeah, I just went to visit Star again last week. So there's a really wonderful housing development group in LA called the Skid Row Housing Trust that's been developing affordable housing in the Skid Row neighborhood for, I think, 30, 35 years. And in their early days, they were acquiring some of the single-room occupancy sort of hotels that were in that area and renovating them for permanent housing. Many of those original hotels were not necessarily designed to be sort of beautiful places, either in the unit or in the larger building. Double-loaded corridors that could be long, dark hallways without necessarily good lighting, small rooms that didn't necessarily accommodate sort of a sense of dignity, again, to use John Kerry's word. And they discovered that, in fact, design was a central piece to the success of their residents. So as they started building ground-up buildings, I think at the beginning they weren't necessarily focused on this. They lucked into working with some really exceptional architects. In the early days, they worked with Julie Eisenberg and Hank Koning, who, instead of thinking, well, we're designing affordable housing, let's design it in the way we've been designing it for a long time, they took, I think, the kind of approach that really good architects take, which is trying to understand how the space and the use of the space is going to enhance the quality of life for the people who are living there and working there. And the first couple of buildings Skid Row designed were wonderful spaces, and they found that the success of their residents increased. And so Skid Row set out on kind of a mission to really bring design excellence to everything they do. They also found that, as we know that, unfortunately, there's often a sort of not in our backyard sort of attitude to affordable housing. Los Angeles has just passed, I believe it's called Proposition H, which is a very large bond measure for affordable housing, which signals that residents of Los Angeles know that they need more affordable housing, especially for people who are currently homeless, but that doesn't necessarily mean they want it in their neighborhood. And Skid Row Housing Trust has found that building really good buildings adds to the streetscape, adds to the cityscape, adds to the neighborhood, and makes the affordable housing argument much more successful. So the Star Apartments is a project finished in, I think, about 4 years ago. It was designed by Michael Maltzen Architects and had our Rose Fellow, Teresa Wong, working as a kind of mediator between the developer and the architect, engaging deeply with residents who'd lived in many of the other Skid Row buildings, trying to ascertain what works, what makes a project successful. And Star Apartments is innovative in a number of different ways. It is using modular construction. There are 102 units that were designed and built as individual units and kind of craned in. The purpose of that was to fully leverage the site. There was an existing building. So this kind of technology was able to increase the density on that site as well. So it's beautiful. It has a lovely second floor kind of exterior space that's above the kind of intensity of the street in Skid Row, but still allows residents to kind of enjoy the outdoor space.
I want to follow up a little bit on the NIMBY, the not in my backyard aspect of this, and with Katie first, and then we'll turn to Eugenio and Brett to see if they think there are local examples of you know, creating developments and projects for people who are homeless, or at least people who have these kind of needs that are a little bit more, you know, sort of better thought out. Because I was talking, and this was a private conversation, I won't relate a name, but I was talking to a friend a few weeks back and who just kind of offered this idea. He said, we just stigmatize homelessness. We almost criminalize it. And so this idea is, well, if there's someone who's homeless or if there's someone who's low income and needs help with housing, we stigmatize it. And so we think that, you know, we're better than that, so therefore we'll just build this block of space somewhere. We'll set it apart from where people want to comfortably live on their own. We'll just find that space. That'll be quote-unquote their space. Obviously, it won't be that very well integrated to the community. It's probably not going to be very thoughtfully designed as space, but at least it's their space, and we just push it aside, as opposed to saying, do we truly care about the people in our community, and how do we make sure that the space is thoughtful, that it's integrated, that gives everyone equal opportunity? I mean, do you agree, Katie, with that we have this way of saying, kind of looking down our nose at this and stigmatizing, and therefore design starts to reflect that feeling?
Yeah, you asked about San Francisco, and I would say there's an interesting sort of dynamic there where, the homeless have been concentrated in the Skid Row neighborhood of Los Angeles through policy, by the way. It's called a containment zone, 50 blocks of a containment zone, with a different set of some rules and regulations. San Francisco doesn't have that, but one of the groups, Community Housing Partners, worked quite a lot in the Tenderloin neighborhood, which was a neighborhood that was similar to Skid Row, always kind of, or for a long time, has been a neighborhood where housing was affordable to low-income people, and there were sort of SROs, single-room occupancy hotels, and the like. And they started, again, using really high-quality design in the Tenderloin. But when the earthquake happened in San Francisco and the Octavia Bridge came down, there was a opportunity for a lot of those sites right near City Hall to be developed. And the activist community made sure that it would not only be for high-income residents, but also for low-income residents. And Community Housing Partners built Richardson Apartments right near City Hall, and a beautiful building designed by David Baker Architects. It makes a great neighbor and a great place to live for those homeless residents. What's interesting now is, of course, Google and Silicon wealth is moving into the Tenderloin neighborhood, for example. So, you know, there's good news and bad news about all of these issues, right? I think we could all agree the idea that you would have policy that makes a containment zone is an awkward idea. I was pretty shocked when I learned that this was a specific policy of the city of Los Angeles to create a containment zone in Skid Row, but it was actually a kind of alignment of activists for the homeless and the poor with city planners as a way to protect that neighborhood as well. So, you know, very complicated issues around gentrification, around, you know, how planning intersects with who we're inviting and sustaining where.
Eugenio, what do you think?
Yes. The NIMBYism is a big issue, and in a lot of cases very subtle economically. You can get, for example, a home leasing, you know, is developing some projects downtown and it's including some affordable housing, and that is a good thing. But there are places that are impenetrable around the city and suburbs. You'll have a hard time trying to develop affordable housing, you know. So what you do is the best that you can with where you are. Fortunately, we have communities here, like on Northeast Rochester, where we have done most of our work, that they don't want to go anywhere. They just want to see the area get better. And we engage the community design center so that the expression of that community was part of whatever future planning we would have in the neighborhood. And so we developed what's called El Camino Revitalization Plan, which has a vision of what the neighbors that live there would like to see their neighborhood look like. And we make sure that anybody who's going to do some work there has to subscribe to some of those things that fit into their project. So, you know, and we empower the neighbors to push back if they have to make sure that happens.
Okay. Brad?
Yeah, NIMBYism is an issue that you face no matter where you go, but some of that comes from the history of affordable housing. When you say affordable housing, people think of something that actually isn't created anymore. There's been many, many years since that historic, poor quality affordable housing has been built. In fact, there's many more examples. Rochester's a great laboratory for affordable housing, where it was part of improving the quality of life in neighborhoods. The number of historic buildings, for example, in Rochester that have been saved because of affordable and mixed income housing development, the neighborhoods would be worse off today if all of those buildings were still vacant and deteriorating. So I think we have a lot of really good examples of very well-designed affordable housing that people can point to help combat the NIMBYism if what's behind the NIMBYism is I don't want that project there. Sometimes it has much more to do with I don't want these people there. And you can do all you can to make something be beautiful. It's hard to combat that attitude. You have to kind of push through it and see if you can get enough people to agree with you and get a project done.
But what's the strategy? I mean, if you are encountering that kind of NIMBYism, do you hold community meetings? Do you ask people to come and ask questions? I mean, what do you do?
Well, my strategy is always you talk with as many people as often as you can for as long as you can, right? And you actually have to develop that relationship that over time will build trust, and you give the real facts. Another very good example, especially when you're talking about supportive housing or housing for the homeless or housing for people with special needs, it's true that no matter where you live, most families are impacted by these topics. And getting to have real community discussion, no matter where you're located, that, you know, people have kids who are facing these problems. People have friends who are facing these problems. That inevitably comes out, and you can start to express the need for housing everywhere.
All right. So, Brett, before our listeners, if they had missed any of the earlier discussion, where's one example you'd point to that it's done well?
I think I'll highlight DePaul. DePaul is a fantastic developer here who also primarily provides services to the people with various mental illnesses. They have a lot of really good projects. Carriage Factory in Susan B. Anthony neighborhood is integrated with people who have mental issues as well as mixed income housing. And then the Riverview Apartments in Henrietta, which provides affordable housing but also housing for people with hearing impairments. These are among the most beautiful buildings you can ever see as well.
Okay. So let me ask just Katie Swenson one more point on that, because Brett raises mental health services. He talked about Riverview. Again, people with whom might have hearing impairments. There's thoughtfulness there. And I know some of the work on the West Coast, Katie, has looked at permanent supportive housing that includes mental and physical health services, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think as a larger community of practitioners, we've all come to really understand that housing is essential but not enough, and that not only does everyone need the kind of access to jobs and transportation and health and other things that we were discussing before, but also that you need to, most often need to incorporate preventative health services, mental health services, and other sort of community empowerment and community building and individual building elements into the program of your building. The bricks and sticks is important, absolutely, but it's also the programming and the kind of human element that happens that can really drive the success of a project for the residents.
Let me read one more listener email, and I'll direct this to Eugenio Marlene, because it's a local listener named Marcia who says, my big concern is the lack of economic integration in Rochester. That, along with the number of boarded up homes and vacant lots that can't be redeveloped because of the lot size, got me thinking as I listened to the opening of the show today. Maybe we could consider the cottages like those being built in Texas. I suspect it would take a change in the zoning laws, but why don't we start building on these lots that are currently sitting abandoned? When new apartments were opened and touted as an answer for those living in the tent city on South Avenue, it was clear that they didn't consult the people living in the tents. You're not going to get people to move living in tents into an apartment where you have to share an elevator, hallway, etc., with other residents. Cottages could be the perfect answer to moving people who are homeless into something with four walls, a roof, and heat. Certainly, Eugenio, thank you, Marcia, for the email. There's probably a lot. She's right when it comes to zoning, size of spaces, etc. But does she have a point with economic integration being a problem?
Great point. We always say that we have a big issue with concentrated poverty. So, and we need to react to those things. The fact of the matter is that we continue to develop in areas that are challenged economically. And whenever we have an opportunity to point out that in some of those areas, there are opportunities for economic growth and and businesses, so that we begin to get out of the cycle of poverty and the concentration that has been so much talked about in the city.
Yeah, Marcia, thank you for that. In fact, I will spend a little time outside of this program kind of looking into what those codes say about that, because it's an interesting subject, and I don't know if it can transfer from Dallas, but maybe it can. I want to thank our guests in studio. You just heard Eugenio Marlin, Executive Vice President of Ibero-American Development Corporation. Always nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Brett Garwood, Chief Operating Officer for Home Leasing, who is sponsoring the Reshaping Rochester series. Thank you, Brett. Good having you here.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Katie Swenson, Vice President of National Design Initiatives at Enterprise Community Partners. You can see her Wednesday night from 7 to 9 at Gleason Works Auditorium. It is a free event, and she will be bringing her ideas, some of what you heard on the program, on Wednesday night. Thank you, Katie. See you Wednesday.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
All right, short break. More Connections coming up.